Hello, you're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 2, What to Do About the State and Revolution. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Last time, we covered the Marxism half of Marxism-Leninism. I'll give you three guesses as to what we're covering this time. Yes, that's right. It's the man, the myth, the legend, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. To familiarize ourselves with the intellectual leader of the Russian Revolution, we're going to go briefly through his early biography up to about 1900 or so. After that, his life becomes intimately intertwined with the rest of the revolutionary narrative, so we'll return to it later. After Lenin the early years, we'll explore two of the biggest pillars that make Leninism, Leninism: the concept of the vanguard party and the role of the state in a revolution. Right away, I'm going to give the disclaimer that all who talk about Russian history, and specifically this period, are contractually obligated to give. All dates are given in the so-called old style. You see, at this time, the Russian Empire still operated on the Julian calendar, which had been implemented by Julius Caesar some 1900 years earlier. But since then, the Gregorian calendar had been invented, and implemented everywhere else in Europe and North America. How the two calendars work is not important. What is important is that the Julian calendar lagged 13 days behind the Gregorian. It's a fairly minor point, except that when we get to 1917, we'll see that certain major events will happen at the ends of the Julian months, and so at the beginnings of the Gregorian months. I'll mention those events when we get there, and I will absolutely mention when the Bolsheviks finally modernized the calendar by switching to the Gregorian. But until then, remember that, until February 1918, the Russian old-style calendar was in effect, and that it lagged 13 days behind the rest of Europe. Lenin was born Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov on the 10th of April, 1870, in the town of Simbirsk, on the Volga River, about halfway between the cities of Kazan and Samara. He would take the name Lenin later in life as a revolutionary pseudonym, possibly derived from the river Lena in Siberia. Vladimir, or as his family called him by the Russian nickname Volodya, was the third of eight children. However, two of the children died in infancy, and I couldn't find anything on their names or how old they were, which leads me to believe that they probably died shortly after childbirth, before even being christened. But I don't actually know. But of the six Ulyanov children who we know survived into adulthood, they were, in order of birth, Anna, Alexander, Vladimir himself, Olga, Dmitri, and Maria. The parents of the family were Ilya Nikolaevich Ulyanov and Maria Alexandrovna Ulyanova. Ilya was from a family of former serfs, but by the time Vladimir was born, he had worked his way to a mid-rank job in the Tsarist bureaucracy. Maria was from an ethnically Jewish family that had converted to Orthodoxy, although it seems Vladimir may not have ever even known about his mother's heritage. As the children grew up, Vladimir idolized his older brother, Alexander, or, as his family called him by the Russian nickname, Sasha. Vladimir was very athletic and loved going on long hikes through the woods. He was also an excellent student and had a fondness for that ancient game of kings, chess. Sadly, the family patriarch, Ilya, passed away very suddenly from a brain hemorrhage in 1886, when Vladimir was only 15. This, understandably, threw the family into disarray, but the future held an even crueler twist for them just a year later. Alexander had gone to study in St. Petersburg as a young man, and there he had fallen in with the revolutionary fashion in Russia at the time, political terrorism. We'll have more to say about the role of terrorism in the revolutionary tradition in the next two episodes, but by the mid-1880s, the explicit goal of these political terrorists was simple: assassinate as many Tsarist officials as possible, including the Tsar himself. Alexander was the leader of a small cell plotting to blow up Tsar Alexander III, but the plot was discovered, foiled, and Alexander Ulyanov, who had taken on the mantle of family patriarch just a year before, was executed by hanging in May 1887, along with his co-conspirators. As one might imagine, this second tragedy also took a great toll on the rest of the family. While Alexander's execution was tragic, this was not where Vladimir started his villain arc. After Alexander's death, Vladimir never swore an oath of undying hatred for the Tsar and his dynasty, devoting himself to its destruction at any cost. No, the impact it had on Vladimir was much more mundane than that. It was a personal, emotional shock that hit his family hard, and Vladimir himself in particular, and was an experience which played its own role, albeit small, in starting Vladimir to think about just how the system worked in Russia, and what might be wrong, and what might need to change to make it better. The truly revolutionary stuff would come later. But not, as it turned out, too much later. By August of the same year his brother was executed, Vladimir was a student at Kazan University, and doing what students always do, going to protests and marches. Vladimir was ultimately arrested for his activities, but his mother, Maria, successfully managed to commute his exile to the family estate in Simbirsk. Eventually, Vladimir was allowed to return to Kazan, but he was barred from studying at the university. It was at this point that Lenin read a book that has been radicalizing people since its publication in 1867, Karl Marx's Capital, Volume 1, and the wheels in little Volodya's head started turning. In 1889, Vladimir moved with his mother and siblings to Samara, the small city further down the Volga from Kazan and Simbirsk. Here, Lenin fell in with other Marxists, joining socialist circles and starting his study of the German philosopher in earnest. He even produced a Russian translation of the Communist Manifesto. Vladimir also became a follower of Georgi Plekhanov, the so-called father of Russian socialism. Plekhanov was a formidable Marxist in his own time, although he would eventually lose his theoretical and revolutionary edge, never even really playing any significant role in the revolutions of 1917, and even becoming, sadly, somewhat of a reactionary before his death from tuberculosis in Finland in 1918. But in the later decades of the 19th century, Plekhanov was the Russian Marxist. He argued that Russia was moving from feudalism to capitalism, and therefore that a young but growing proletariat would bring revolution and socialism to Russia. This flew in the face of what had been established revolutionary dogma in Russia at the time, that the peasantry would be the engine of the coming revolution. But when, in the 1880s, capitalist industrial production actually did take off in Russia, Plekhanov's analyses and predictions suddenly gained him and Marxism an entire generation of adherents. From Samara, Vladimir moved to St. Petersburg in 1893, where he joined the Social Democrats and met his future wife, Nadezhda Konstantinovna Krupskaya. Nadezhda, or as her family would have called her by the Russian nickname Nadia, was a revolutionary in her own right, and we will have separate episodes on her and other important women of the Soviet Union in due time. I don't want anyone out there to think I'm just skipping right past her. But for now, we're going to wrap up this early bio of Lenin. From St. Petersburg, Vladimir traveled to Switzerland, where he met Plekhanov, who had been living abroad for several years as one of the Russian emigre revolutionaries. Plekhanov had founded the group The Emancipation of Labor, and when Vladimir returned from Switzerland, he brought with him banned materials from the group for dissemination in Russia. However, he was caught, and spent a year in prison without trial before being sentenced to exile in Siberia. Vladimir was allowed to spend his exile with his mother and sisters, as well as, eventually, Nadezhda. Before Vladimir had left St. Petersburg for Siberia, he had proposed to Nadezhda. In 1896, when she was also arrested and exiled in a separate case, she requested permission to spend her exile with Vladimir, and the request was granted. Once the two reunited, they were wed. Vladimir and Nadezhda were well known for being very private about their personal life together, but while they never had any children, Nadezhda was unable to bear any, there is every indication that the two did share true love, respect, and affection for each other. This brings us up to about the year 1900 in Vladimir Lenin's life, and the end of our little biography. After a short break, we're going to shift our attention to the first pillar of Leninism, the Vanguard Party. Just what was this party supposed to be? Why was one needed? And what should its stated goals and adopted tactics be? The answers to these and other questions lie in Lenin's first great theoretical work, Что делать? Published in 1902, the title Что делать has always been translated into English as What is to be done? But a more literal translation from the Russian is the simpler What to do? I'm a bit of a stickler when it comes to translations, and so I toyed with the idea of using What to do as my translation of the title. But in the end, I did not want to flout established convention and create confusion with the usual English title, especially among those of you who have heard of this work before. But I did want to let you know that if you're ever at trivia night at your local bar and the totally cool and not at all nerdy question is, name the 1900 work by Lenin in which he argued for the importance of a vanguard party, just know the answer, What to Do, should be perfectly acceptable. The title, What is to be Done, was an homage to the novel of the same name by Nikolai Chernyshevsky, published in 1863. Chernyshevsky's novel was an early attempt to portray the ideals toward which revolutionaries of his day should strive, and so the name fit, even if the ideals in favor of which Lenin argued were drastically different from those 40 years earlier. Whereas the 1963 novel was a fictional telling of the lives of revolutionary intelligentsia at the time, Lenin's theoretical work argued vehemently for the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, the Marxist Party in Russia of which he was a member, to pursue two strategic goals: the transformation of the RSDLP into a mass vanguard party of the workers drawn from the ranks of the proletariat, and a party newspaper to help coordinate and organize the activities of the party across the vastness of the Russian Empire. For the rest of the episode, I will be providing context for Lenin's ideas, but then, with just one or two exceptions, providing his words on the matter instead of mine. In other words, I'm not going to be summarizing Lenin's arguments so much as simply presenting them to you. I'm doing this for two reasons. First, Lenin says it just so much better than I can. But also, we are often presented with summations of the ideas of other people instead of the ideas themselves. And while this can be a practical way of going through certain material, as I've said before, one of the main goals of this entire podcast is to try to shift our understanding of the Soviet Union as a whole. All I was ever given when I was studying this history in college was pithy summaries of Lenin's ideas, and not very good ones, as it turned out. When I read Lenin in his own words for the first time, it was eye-opening, to say the least. So I do not see how I can now do anything but just let Lenin cook. To start with the Vanguard Party first, this concept is usually mischaracterized as being a shadowy cabal of die-hard revolutionaries working behind the scenes, separate and above the workers, with the goal of manipulating the hapless and duped masses into stirring the pot of revolution so that the cabal can then leap from the shadows to capitalize on the chaos of the moment in the name of the workers. But once power is obtained, the workers have served their purpose and are immediately discarded and excluded from the political process. It may come as a surprise to learn that this could not be further from the truth of what Lenin's Vanguard Party is. He conceived of the Vanguard Party as a reconciliation between the spontaneity of mass revolts common under capitalism and the need for Marxist theory. We'll see in detail as we move forward what that is supposed to look like. One of the things Lenin's works are known for is being polemical, not just expository. That is, half the time he is responding directly to arguments being made in real time by his contemporaries, while the other half, Lenin is presenting his own original thoughts. I'm sure many of you will be relieved to hear that I am going to skip the polemics and focus on Lenin's own arguments. However, we do need to touch on two main tendencies of the left of Lenin's day that he is arguing against, because it is necessary to understand why Lenin is arguing as he is, and that includes juxtaposing his ideas with the other options that were being discussed at the time. In broad strokes, the two tendencies on the left that Lenin is disputing are what he called spontaneity, which I read as meaning basically anarchism, although he never uses that term himself explicitly, and economism. Anarchism itself is one of the oldest traditions on the revolutionary left. Many of you listening are probably aware that the father of Russian anarchism, Mikhail Bakunin, was a bitter rival of Marx and Engels. We will go more into the existence and role of anarchism in the Soviet Union when the time comes, but if I had to summarize the key difference, the root cause of the disagreement and hostility between anarchists and Marxist socialists, it would be that anarchism emphasizes the role of power dynamics and how groups and individuals relate to each other along axes of power being exercised. This is in contrast to Marxism, which emphasizes the role of class dynamics and how groups and individuals relate to each other along axes of control and ownership of the means of production. The trope of anarchists as being maniacs who just want to blow everything up is yet another caricature of the left. Although this caricature does contain some truth, as the history of anarchism in both Russia and the US attests. But what anarchists really want is to flatten hierarchies. Instead of vertical authoritarian power structures, which they eschew, they want to build horizontal democratic power structures, which they idolize. Anarchists want, for the most part, the same end result as Marxist socialists, including Lenin himself, a society without domination, exploitation, or control by one person over another. But the rub here is the question of how to achieve this kind of society. As we will see later, Lenin has a very definite idea of how to achieve and defend a revolutionary society, which puts him at direct odds with anarchists, both in his own day and right through to our time. The other tendency Lenin is arguing against is economism. This was the position that the most workers could and should strive for under capitalism was an equal piece of the economic pie. That is, workers should not engage directly in political matters. Instead, they should just focus on their own material well-being under capitalism and leave the dirty matters of politics to the dirty politicians. We will see that Lenin also rejected this assertion, arguing passionately that there is no separation of economics and politics when it comes to challenging capitalism. And finally, a quick, necessary note. As we go through what is to be done, it's important to remember that the term social democracy was, at the time of Lenin's writing, the generally used term for what we would today call socialism. The change in terminology occurs during World War I, and, as it turns out, is extremely important. I will explain why later in this episode. But for now, when you hear the term social democracy, just think socialism, even though in today's language, social democracy is very different from socialism. Yes, I know, keeping up with the ever-shifting nature of leftist politics is just, the funnest. The starting point for Lenin in What Is to Be Done is the question of ideology. Lenin asserts that, since class pervades modern society, there is no neutral or objective ideology. Here we come to the first of our passages. Quote, "Since there can be no talk of an independent ideology worked out by the working masses themselves in the course of their movement, then the question stands only thus, bourgeois or socialist ideology. There is no middle here, since humanity has not worked out any third ideology, for in general, in a society being torn apart by class contradictions, there can never even be an ideology that is outside of or above class. Therefore, any disparagement of socialist ideology, any and all strain from it, entails by its very nature a strengthening of bourgeois ideology." End quote. Lenin is clear. When it comes to ideology in capitalist society, we are faced with a binary choice. Certain ideas can be more or less bourgeois or proletarian, but they cannot be neither, nor can they be above the fray of ideology altogether. Next, he addresses what was, at the time, held up to be the proper way to pursue a revolution, at least in Russia, spontaneity. A quick note for context in this next excerpt, he mentions the Credo program, which was an economist movement arising in some social democratic parties in Europe at the time. Also, there is a German word which Lenin has in the original text untranslated, and so I have left it in for effect. But my apologies to any German speakers listening for my pronunciation. I've never studied German a day in my life. Quote, some talk about spontaneousness, but a spontaneous development of the workers' movement leads precisely to its subordination to bourgeois ideology. It follows precisely the credo program, for a spontaneous workers' movement is trade unionism. It is Neugewerkschaftlerei. And trade unionism means the same thing as the intellectual enslavement of the workers by the bourgeoisie. Therefore, our task, the task of social democracy, consists of a struggle with spontaneousness, consists of pulling the workers' movement away from the spontaneous tendency of trade unionism under the wing of the bourgeoisie, and setting it under the wing of revolutionary social democracy. End quote. He continues a few paragraphs later, quote, but why, the reader will ask, does a spontaneous movement, a movement along the line of least resistance, lead precisely to the rule of bourgeois ideology? It is due to the simple reason that bourgeois ideology, by virtue of its very origin, is many times older than socialist ideology, that it is more thoroughly worked out, that it controls incalculably more means of dissemination. End quote. The assertion here is that spontaneous movements, which by definition lack any leadership or cohesive organization at their outset, are ill-equipped to resist the influence of an older, established, and officially sanctioned bourgeois ideology. We have seen this in the United States many times in its history. In my lifetime, examples were the anti-Iraq and Afghanistan war movements, the Occupy movement, and student protests at universities. Many of the movements from the 20th century also fall into this category: the civil rights movement, the trade union movement, the feminist movement. Sadly, no matter how brightly or hotly they burn out of the gate, eventually they fall under the sway of one of the two major political parties we have in the US, or they simply lose steam and peter out. That's not to say they are incapable of effecting any kind of change whatsoever, and to the extent they do manage to gain a solution to a pressing issue, these movements deserve recognition. I want to be clear, I am not saying these movements were pointless or were not worthwhile. But if you haven't noticed, despite all of them, capitalism is still around. Next, Lenin talks about the role that social democracy has to play in a workers' movement. Quote, social democracy guides the struggle of the working class not only for beneficial conditions of the sale of labor power, but also for the destruction of the social system which forces the propertyless to sell themselves to the rich. Social democracy presents the working class not in its relation to only a given group of employers, but in its relation to all classes of modern society, to the state as an organized political force. From this, it is understood that social democrats not only cannot limit themselves to an economic battle, but they also cannot allow the organizing of economic denunciations to constitute the majority of their activity. We must actively take on the political development of the working class, the development of its political consciousness. It is necessary to agitate concerning every concrete manifestation of this, comment, he means political, oppression. Just as we began agitating concerning concrete manifestations of economic oppression. End quote. In other words, socialists take on the responsibility of educating the working class on both economic and political matters. This is, again, in contrast to economism, which eschews the political in favor of exclusively the economic. The embodiment of the economist tendency on the left is trade unionism, as he mentioned earlier. But keep in mind, Lenin is not saying that trade unions are bad. No socialist worth their salt would ever say that. All he's pointing to is the limits of the revolutionary potential of trade unions as institutions in capitalism. Quote, the economic struggle is a collective struggle of workers with owners for beneficial conditions of the sale of labor power, for the improvement of labor conditions and the life of workers. This struggle is of necessity a professional struggle, because the conditions of labor are extremely varied in different professions, and subsequently, a struggle for the improvement of these conditions cannot be waged except within the professions. End quote. So to recap, Spontaneous workers' movements may have limited successes, but they will always fail to achieve escape velocity from capitalism. Because they lack a clear ideological framework from which to launch their movements, the center of gravity that is the dominant bourgeois ideology will always kill the momentum, and the movements will always come crashing back down to earth. As for economism, trade unions are only ever occupied with carving out the best possible conditions for their member workers at any given moment, which is certainly admirable and can serve as a radicalizing moment for workers. If they lose the struggle, or if they see just how far the bosses will go to avoid making any concessions whatsoever, they may start to see the futility of taking an approach so limited in scope. But economism itself is also a dead end for the workers as a class, because all it's doing is fighting for a better share of the pie. It's not challenging the system as a whole, and so it can never actually lead to the overthrow of capitalism. From here, after arguing what doesn't work, Lenin switches focus to what does, a vanguard party. First, he defines such a party as, quote, a small, tightly knit core of the most reliable, experienced, and seasoned workers, which has trusted people in the main localities and is connected, according to the rules of strictest secrecy, with an organization of revolutionaries, is fully able to carry out, with the widest cooperation of the masses and without any formalization, all functions which fall to the professional organization, and besides that, carry them out precisely the way in which it is desirable for social democracy. Only by such a path can the stabilization and development of a professional social democratic movement, despite all policing, be achieved. End quote. Now, I'm sure some of you listening heard the buzzword secrecy and immediately thought, wait, so it is about a cabal of revolutionaries trying to take power. If you did think that, congratulations, you're expressing the same concern some of Lenin's contemporaries did. There was a lot of criticism of the idea even at the time, but Lenin, of course, came prepared. He addressed both the needs for leaders and the need for secrecy in the vanguard party. Quote, the concentration of all secretive functions in the hands of perhaps a small number of professional revolutionaries does not at all think for everyone that the multitudes will not take an actionable part in the movement. On the contrary, these professional revolutionaries will propagate as a crowd in greater and greater numbers, for the multitudes will then know that it is not sufficient for just a few students and workers conducting an economic struggle to gather together in order to form a committee, but that it takes years to develop oneself into a professional revolutionary, and the multitudes will be thinking not only about amateurism, but about precisely this kind of development. The centralization of secretive functions of the organization does not at all entail the centralization of all functions of the movement. The active participation of the widest masses in illegal literature will not decrease, but increase tenfold due to the fact that a dozen professional revolutionaries centralized the secretive functions of this matter. End quote. He continues later, quote, the widest and most active participation of the masses will not only not suffer, but will, on the contrary, win much due to the fact that a dozen experienced revolutionaries, no less professionally trained than our police, centralize all secretive aspects of the matter. The preparation of leaflets, the development of an approximate plan, the appointment of a platoon of leaders for each neighborhood of the city, for each factory block, for each educational facility, etc. The centralization of the most secretive functions by an organization of revolutionaries will not weaken, but enrich the breadth and content of the activities of an entire mass of other organizations which are intended for the wider public and are therefore as informal as possible and as least secretive as possible. End quote. He also addresses the concern that a centralized party will lead to the neglect and atrophy of local and provincial branches of activists. Quote, the question is about the relationship of local and national work. The concern expressed is whether the information of a centralizing organization will lead to the transfer of the center of gravity from the former to the latter. Will this not harm the movement, having weakened the durability of our connections with the working masses and generally the stability of local agitation? We say to this that our movement for the last few years has suffered in point of fact because local activists are too overwhelmed with local work. because it is absolutely necessary to shift somewhat the center of gravity to national work, and that such a shift will not weaken but strengthen both the durability of our connections with the working masses and the stability of our local agitation." End quote. From these passages, we see that Lenin views the secretive core of the Vanguard Party to be, in effect, a necessary and efficient division of labor. The core basically takes care of all the administrative duties of the movement away from the prying eyes of the authorities and the bosses, so that the rank and file can focus on the work of agitation and organization out in the open, in public, and in view of everyone. And the party branches located in the more remote areas of the country will benefit from being able to plug into an overarching national revolutionary organization, which in turn is able to provide whatever resources and support are necessary. But this still leaves open the question of democracy in such an organization. If this division of labor is indeed the most efficient way of building a movement capable of challenging and overthrowing capitalism, it does not necessarily follow that it is democratic. The core of the secretive revolutionaries could still be undemocratic, isolated from the masses, and directing the workers to do their bidding. Lenin responds to the objection that the Vanguard Party fails to uphold the so-called democratic principle. Quote, "And now we will look a bit closer at this principle, which is set forth by the economists. Anyone will likely agree that a wide democratic principle includes the two following necessary conditions. First, complete openness, and second, elections for all functions. Without openness, it would be laughable to talk of democracy, and the kind of openness at that which is not limited by the members of the organization. We will call the German Socialist Party democratic, for there everything is done openly, right up to the session of the Party Congress. But nobody will call democratic the kind of organization which is closed to all non-members of the party by a shroud of mystery. It must be asked, what is the point of putting forth a wide democratic principle when the fundamental condition of this principle is impractical for a secret organization? This phrase testifies to the complete misunderstanding of the vital tasks of the movement in regards to organization." End quote. So in regards to the first condition of democracy, that of complete openness, Lenin is saying openness within a secret organization is simply an impossibility, for the organization would cease to be secret if it held that principle. When addressing the second condition of elections, Lenin engages so much in discussion of various past and contemporary revolutionary organizations that I found it impossible to find even one section that lent itself easily to a quoted excerpt that summarizes his position. So instead, this will be just one of a handful of times when I will summarize the broad strokes of Lenin's arguments in my own words. Lenin argues that the elections implied by the wide democratic principle being discussed, elections which we would call in the United States of the early to mid 21st century free and fair, require a certain kind of basic political freedom that simply did not exist in the Russian Empire of the turn of the 20th century. He points out that such an approach, where the revolutionaries are widely known by the general population of the country, where their past and current activities and the kinds of policies they advocate are widely disseminated in newspapers, would only serve to hand the political police of the time everything they need to neuter the Vanguard Party, whether through buying off individuals standing for election in the party or through open arrests of any principled activists not for sale. He therefore concludes that these kinds of open elections, like the principles of openness in general, would spell doom for a secretive organization. But it is important to be very clear what Lenin is saying here and what he is not saying. While he argues that the Vanguard Party must be secretive in the context of the wider society, he is not arguing that the party must eschew openness and accountability of its leaders within itself. Although he does not lay this out in what is to be done, we will see once we get into the revolutionary period, and I promise that day is coming, that Lenin advocated for the organizational principle of democratic centralism for the Vanguard Party. Democratic centralism is the principle of engaging in fierce debate of all competing and conflicting viewpoints and ideas within the party. That's the democratic part. but that once a vote is held and a decision made about what to do, all members of the party are expected to abide by it. That's the centralism. People tend to focus more on the centralism part of that equation while ignoring the democracy built inherently into the principle. Democratic centralism allows for the distilling of the best ideas and the best application of them through the discussion portion, while also having the advantage of the entire organization pushing as one in the same direction to pursue or enforce a group decision, thereby generating the kind of political power most leftist groups in the U.S. today can only dream of. We'll get more into democratic centralism and see how it worked in practice in the Soviet case as we move along, but I wanted to close out this look on Lenin's views of democracy and the vanguard party, not with what kind of democracy he did not believe in, but with the kind of democracy he did believe in. Next, Lenin discusses what kind of relationship the vanguard party should have to the workers themselves. Quote, "The very first and most pressing of our obligations is the facilitation of the development of revolutionary workers who stand on the same level as the intelligentsia revolutionaries in regards to party activity. Therefore, the main focus must be placed on raising the workers to revolutionaries, not at all on lowering ourselves to the level of the working masses, as the economists want, or to the level of worker intermediaries." End quote. So the vanguard party's role is not to manipulate or control the workers. It is a tool at the disposal of the working class in their struggle against capitalism and the bourgeoisie for the purpose of developing workers into ready revolutionaries. Finally, we have Lenin's explanation of what the long-term strategic goal of the vanguard party should be. Quote, "Our tactical plan consists of the rejection of an immediate call to attack, of the demand to establish a proper siege of the enemy's citadel, or otherwise of the demand to direct all efforts to gather, organize, and mobilize a permanent army." End quote. Further, he references a man named Nadezhdin, who, he says, quote, "objects that a systematically organized army would be engaged in something which would tear it away from the crowd, when in actuality it would be engaged exclusively in comprehensive and all-enveloping political agitation, that is, precisely in work which brings closer and unites into one the spontaneous destructive force of the crowd and the conscious destructive force of an organization of revolutionaries." End quote. And finally, quote, "only such an organization will secure for a social democratic fighting organization the necessary flexibility, that is, the ability to adapt immediately to the most varied and quickly changing conditions of the struggle. The ability, on the one hand, to pull back from engaging in the open field with an enemy with overwhelming force when he has gathered all his forces at one point, and on the other hand, to take advantage of the unwieldiness of this enemy and attack him at the time and place where he least expects an attack." End quote. Lenin closes out his discussion with the role of the vanguard with overtly martial language. He envisions the vanguard party as a proletarian army, guided by ideology and strategy that has been hashed out in rigorous debate, yet pursued with zeal, in order to lay siege to the bourgeoisie and eventually overthrow it. Like I said, he takes the term class warfare very, very seriously. The final chapter of What is to be Done is dedicated to arguing for a central party newspaper. But he makes this argument with reference to a myriad of Russian and foreign newspapers and organizations, and it is again impossible for me to find a singular excerpt to describe his general view on the matter, so again, I'm going to summarize his position myself. Fortunately, the position is a fairly simple one, that a singular national newspaper, which can report on current events as well as provide agitation and education for the party, is an absolutely essential tool the party must wield. Of course, newspapers today, and here I mean specifically the medium of newspapers, not journalists or their profession, are all but obsolete, but at the time they were the effective means of mass dissemination of information. And that's why Lenin advocated for one. Without such a newspaper, the organizational goals of a national vanguard party would be impossible to achieve. But if we were to update Lenin's argument for the mid-21st century, it's clear, at least to me, that Lenin would argue that the party must use the indispensable tool of our age, the internet, to achieve those same goals of agitation, education, and coordination. Now, this is not the place to get into exactly what that would look like, or the myriad of problems with the internet as it currently exists in all its cesspool glory. But the point remains that using the tools available to agitate and educate the proletariat as a class was the second big argument of what is to be done. And so we have come to the end of exploring Lenin's first great theoretical work. To recap, Lenin argues for the creation of a vanguard party of workers that strives to raise the class consciousness and revolutionary potential of the proletariat as a class. This party must operate on principles of secrecy to avoid being infiltrated or destroyed by the authorities, as well as the principle of democratic centralism. He believes this approach constitutes the best chance the workers have of actually overthrowing capitalism, as it overcomes the weaknesses of spontaneous action and the ineffectiveness of narrow economism. To that end, the party must use the social media of the time, a newspaper, to coordinate its efforts for maximum effectiveness. Okay, we'll take a little break here, and when we come back, we'll close with what is undoubtedly Lenin's most famous theoretical work. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. Государство и революция, or State and Revolution, was written in 1917, during the very throes of the Russian Revolution. So not only was Lenin busy trying to guide the Bolsheviks through the choppy waters of the events on the ground during that time, not only was he dodging the police and counter-revolutionaries to avoid imprisonment or murder, he also somehow found the time to write one of his greatest works. That's the rise and grind mindset we need. Once again, we need to set the stage with a little context for when this was written. Remember when, in the last section, I mentioned there was a tectonic shift in terminology away from social democracy in the wake of World War I? Well, this is where it becomes important to understand what happened. In August of 1914, as the various empires of Europe were declaring war on each other, in Germany, there was a vote in the Reichstag for funding the nation's war efforts. The SPD, or the Social Democratic Party of Germany, was, at the time, an important bloc in the German government, as well as the single biggest socialist party in Europe. The party's international role was so great, in fact, that they were the leaders of the revolutionary organization known as the Second International Working Men's Association, or, as it is always abbreviated, just the Second International. The Second International claimed to be carrying the torch of the First International that had been founded by socialists of the previous generation, including Marx and Engels, and had existed from 1864 to 1876. As the various social democratic parties had anticipated for years the outbreak of World War I, each party had made declarations promising not to support their national government's war effort, in order to undermine the coming war. Well, when the vote came in the German Reichstag, the SPD leaders and representatives serving in the government shocked the entire world by voting for funding the war. This was, of course, a gross betrayal of the rank and file of the party, and of everything the Second International had stood for, and it led to the almost immediate dissolution of that body. It was so shocking, in fact, that Lenin, who at the time was living in exile abroad, did not believe the initial newspaper reports of the vote, thinking it was a trick by the capitalists to sow dissension among the socialists. But it was true, and social democracy was exposed as what Lenin would later call opportunism, that is, the phenomenon of individuals claiming the mantle of the revolutionary socialist truly interested in overthrowing capitalism in order to ride the wave of popular support for socialism, but who, when it comes time to act, inevitably betray the trust of the masses, throw their lots in with the capitalist governments, and preach reconciliation and reform instead of revolution. It is within this context that Lenin wrote State and Revolution, and it is to the Herculean task of combating the spread of opportunism on the left and arguing for the absolute necessity of a full-blown revolution that he set himself. State and Revolution is another example of Lenin's highly polemical style, and we will again be avoiding the polemics as much as possible. However, State and Revolution was written as much as a repudiation of opportunism as a guide for how to conceive of the role of the state in society and what the goals of a revolutionary proletarian movement should be in relation to the state. So there's no way to avoid the polemics altogether. Lenin sets the stage thus, quote, "The unheard-of horrors and troubles of the war, which is currently dragging on, make the position of the masses unbearable and heighten their indignation. The international proletarian revolution is clearly growing. The question of its relationship to the state is acquiring a practical significance." End quote. He then immediately identifies a dangerous challenge facing socialism. Quote, "That which has happened many times in history with the teachings of revolutionary thinkers and the leaders of the oppressed classes in their struggle for liberation is happening right now with Marx's teachings. The oppressing classes have always paid great revolutionaries during their lifetime with constant persecution, met their teachings with the fiercest ire, the most rabid hatred, the most reckless march of lies and slander. After their deaths, attempts are made to turn them into harmless icons, so to say, to canonize them, to grant familiar praise to their name in order to calm and make fools of the oppressed classes, all while eviscerating the content of the revolutionary teaching, dulling its revolutionary sharpness, impoverishing it. It is in this repurposing of Marxism that the bourgeoisie and the opportunists within the workers' movements are now coming together." End quote. If you're from the U.S., you're probably familiar with the term whitewashing when applied to political activists. From Thomas Paine through Albert Einstein to Martin Luther King Jr., radical thinkers, and those we now label as progressives, have suffered the fate Lenin here outlines. The fact that a Russian revolutionary writing over 100 years ago described the phenomenon as it was happening to a German philosopher and revolutionary from even 30 years before that, and is the same tactic used even today in the United States, demonstrates just how timeless this tactic against revolutionaries is. Having thus drawn the battle lines, Lenin launches into a full-throated defense of the Marxist conception of the state, defending not only its validity, but the necessity to properly understand the nature of the state. Quote, "The state is the product and manifestation of the irreconcilability of class contradictions. The state arises in those places, at those times, and to the extent that class contradictions objectively cannot be reconciled. And the opposite, the existence of a state demonstrates that class contradictions are irreconcilable." End quote. He later continues, quote, "According to Marx, the state is a tool of class domination, a tool of oppression of one class by another. It is the creation of order which legalizes and enforces this oppression by tempering class conflict. According to petty bourgeois politicians, order is precisely the reconciliation of the classes, and not the oppression of one class by another. To temper conflict means to reconcile, not to take away from the oppressed classes definite means and methods of struggle for the overthrow of the oppressors." End quote. In the United States, and I'm sure in many other nations, but I speak here now about the U.S. as my home, we have a long tradition of distrusting the government. We hear all the time, the government is only making things worse. Ronald Reagan famously claimed the 9 scariest words in the English language were, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." There are economists and politicians the world over who insist that to secure freedom for society, the role of government must be as limited as possible. There are even some who believe it is necessary to abolish the state altogether. But Lenin is defending Marx and Engels' conceptualization of the state as a necessary feature of any class society. It is impossible to abolish the state under capitalism, because the state is what makes capitalism possible. The existence of a state is the only way society can function when it is divided into classes. Far from being an outside force, issuing decisions and judgments guided by some sort of objective metric of truth or justice, it is a tool, a weapon, wielded by one class to maintain its dominant position in society. To harken back to last episode, the state is one of the most crucial components of the superstructure that arises from the economic base. But, theoretically, if the state arises out of the necessity to manage class contradictions, could not the state be abolished if class contradictions themselves cease to exist? Lenin reminds us that Engels certainly thought so, and that the German socialists believed in the withering away of the state. This phenomenon of the withering away of the state was first posited by Engels in the Anti-Düring, which was a polemic against the positions and theories of a guy named, you guessed it, Düring. Engels argued that after a socialist revolution, once classes are abolished not by force, but by a restructuring of society with equal and egalitarian relations between workers as both producers and consumers, the state will cease to be necessary. Since it arises out of class antagonisms and contradictions within society that must be managed, once the antagonisms and contradictions are removed, the state will be placed in the Museum of Antiquities, next to the spinning wheel and the bronze axe. Lenin adds his own thoughts on the matter. Quote, "The replacement of the bourgeois state by the proletarian is not possible without a violent revolution. The destruction of the proletarian state, that is, the destruction of the state as a whole, is not possible by any way other than withering." End quote. After defending the Marxist conception of the state and its role in class society, Lenin moves on to the tasks that faced revolutionaries of his day. The first step in overthrowing the bourgeoisie is to deprive them of this tool by taking over the state, and the second step is to turn the state against the bourgeoisie. Quote, "The state is a particular organization of force. It is the organization of violence for the suppression of some class. Which class must the proletariat suppress? Of course, only the exploiter class, that is, the bourgeoisie. The laborers need a state only for suppressing the resistance of the exploiters, and only the proletariat, as the single, truly revolutionary class, the only class capable of uniting all laborers and exploited peoples in the struggle against the bourgeoisie in its complete displacement, is capable of managing the suppression, of making it a reality." End quote. If under capitalism the state is the embodiment of the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, then under socialism the state becomes the embodiment of the dictatorship of the proletariat. And this kind of socialist worker state is necessary to ensure the success of the entire socialist project, lest counter-revolutionary forces succeed in reasserting the rule of the bourgeoisie. But protecting the revolution and its advances and successes is only one function of the proletarian state. Another important function is to simplify, as much as possible, all official state functions. The goal is to reduce or remove completely any need for specialized bureaucratic knowledge and training. He, of course, recognizes that positions and functions will always require technical knowledge in whatever field is concerned, whether it's engineering, education, the military, or what have you. But the goal is to make the bureaucracy itself as mundane as possible, and in this way, make the state as accessible to all as possible. This facilitates both the democratization of the state and its withering away. Quote, "Capitalist culture has created large-scale production, factories, railroads, the post office, telephones, and so on. And on this basis, a tremendous majority of the functions of old state power have been so simplified and can be reduced to such simplistic operations of registering, recording, and verifying that these functions will become entirely accessible to all literate people, that it is entirely possible to carry out these functions for a regular worker's wage, that it is possible and necessary to erase any and all trace of anything privileged and overbearing. Total electability and replaceability at any time of all official posts without exception. Reduction of their compensation to a regular worker's wage. These simple and self-evident democratic measures, completely uniting the interests of workers and the majority of peasants, serve at the same time as a bridge of sorts leading from capitalism to socialism. These measures concern a governmental, purely political restructuring of society. But they take on, needless to say, their entire point and meaning only in connection with a realization of, or preparation for, the expropriation of the expropriators, that is, with a transition from capitalist private property to the means of production as common property. End quote. The final point addressed by Lenin is that of democracy in both a bourgeois and a proletarian state. To close us out, I'll let Lenin tell us what he believes is the true nature of bourgeois democracy, and how proletarian democracy will improve on it. First, he describes the limits of democracy under bourgeois rule. Quote, "But this democracy is always constrained by a tight framework of capitalist exploitation, and therefore always remains, in essence, democracy for the minority, only for the owner class, only for the rich." End quote. This is a sentiment and observation shared by many people across the world today. If you are rich, there is almost no limit to what you can do, or how much influence you can exert on the government. But what if you're poor? Quote, "Modern wage slaves, under conditions of capitalist exploitation, remain crushed by need and poverty to such a degree that they have no time for democracy, or for politics. Under the regular, peaceful course of events, the majority of the population is removed from participation in socio-political life." End quote. How many of us are too tired after a long day of work, of taking care of our families and communities, to truly engage in the civic and democratic processes of our society? Too many of us, that's for sure. He then gives specific examples of how democracy is limited for the working masses. Quote, "If we look a bit closer at the mechanism of capitalist democracy, we will see everywhere and all around, in the minor, allegedly minor details of voting law, residential qualifications, the exclusion of women, etc., as well as the technique of representative institutions, and also in the de facto obstacles to the right of assembly, public buildings are not for the poor, and also in the purely capitalist organization of the daily press, etc., etc., we see here limitations after limitations of democracy. These limitations, reservations, exclusions, and obstacles for the poor appear minor, especially to the eye of one who has never himself seen want and never been close with the oppressed classes in their daily life, as is the case for 9 out of 10, if not 99 out of 100 bourgeois publicists and politicians. But taken together, these limitations exclude and force out the poor from politics, from active participation in democracy." End quote. In the United States over the last decade, we have witnessed all sorts of attempts to make voting, the most basic civil engagement available to us, and in many cases, the only form of civil engagement available to us, more difficult, through voter ID laws, the closing or relocating of polling stations, all sorts of rules for voting by mail. Lenin, writing about the same phenomenon more than 100 years ago in an entirely different country, proves this is another favorite tactic of the bourgeoisie. Lenin then gives a lengthy but thorough summation of his view of democracy and the state under capitalism, during the transition from capitalism to communism, and finally, under communism. Quote, "And so, in a capitalist society, we have a truncated, wretched, false democracy, a democracy only for the rich, for the minority. The dictatorship of the proletariat, the period of transition to communism, will, for the first time, give a democracy for the people, for the majority, along with the necessary suppression of the minority, of the exploiters. Only communism alone is able to give an actually full democracy, and the more full it is, the sooner it will become unneeded and will die off on its own. In other words, under capitalism, we have a state in the proper sense of the word, a special machine for the suppression of one class by another, and in this instance, of the majority by the minority. It's understandable that for the success of a matter such as the systematic suppression of the majority of the exploited by the minority of exploiters, extreme savagery is needed, the brutality of suppression. Seas of blood are needed through which humanity makes its way in a state of slavery, serfdom, and wage slavery. Furthermore, during the transition from capitalism to communism, suppression is still necessary, but it is here the suppression of the minority of exploiters by the majority of the exploited. A particular apparatus, a particular machinery for suppression, a state, is still necessary, but it is here a transitional state. It is not a state in the proper sense, for the suppression of the minority of exploiters by the majority of yesterday's wage slaves is a matter that is to such an extent comparatively easy, simple, and natural that it will cost much less blood than the suppression of insurrections of slaves, serfs, and wage slaves. It will cost humanity far less. And it is compatible with the spreading of democracy to such an overwhelming majority of the population that the requirement for a particular machinery for suppression begins to disappear. The exploiters, naturally, cannot suppress the people without the most complicated machinery for carrying out this task. But the people can suppress the exploiters with even very simple machinery, almost without any machinery at all, without a particular apparatus, by the simple organization of the armed masses, such as councils of worker and soldier deputies, we will note, running ahead. Finally, only communism creates the total lack of a need for a state, since there is nobody to suppress. Nobody in the sense of a class, in the sense of a systematic struggle with a defined portion of the population. We are not utopians, and we do not at all deny the possibility and unavoidability of excesses of individuals, as well as the necessity to suppress these kinds of excesses. But, first of all, a particular machinery, a particular apparatus for suppression, is not needed for this. The armed people themselves will do this with the same simplicity and ease with which any crowd of civilized people, even in modern society, pull apart fighters or do not allow the rape of a woman. And second of all, we know that the root social cause of excesses composed of the violation of the rules of common living are the exploitation of the masses, their need and poverty. With the removal of this main cause, excesses will inevitably start to wither away. We do not know how quickly or gradually, but we do know that they will wither away. With their withering away, withers away also the state. End quote. The final question Lenin touches on throughout his book, which I want to discuss, is that of the anarchist approach to revolution and the role of the state, as this approach runs directly counter and antithetical to the Marxist socialist approach. I said before that anarchists are mostly concerned with the use of power, but to expand on that just a little, they believe that the true goal of a revolution should be the abolition of power structures, and above all, of the state. Lenin addresses multiple ideological differences with the anarchists, but to keep this episode from going any longer than it already is, and if you're still listening, you deserve a round of applause, I'm going to provide only one excerpt which sums up as well as any excerpt could the key difference between anarchists and Marxist socialists. Lenin says that Marx, quote, is not at all against the idea that the state will disappear with the disappearance of classes, or that it will be abolished with their abolition. But he is against the idea that the workers should refuse the use of arms, of organized violence, that is, of a state which must serve the goal of breaking the resistance of the bourgeoisie. So that others would not distort the true meaning of his struggle with anarchism, Marx purposely underlines the revolutionary and transitional form of the state, which is necessary for the proletariat. The proletariat needs a state only for a time. We do not at all differ with the anarchists on the question of the abolition of the state as a goal. We contend that for the achievement of this goal, the temporary use of instruments, means, and methods of state power is necessary against the exploiters, just as the temporary dictatorship of the proletariat is necessary for the destruction of classes. Marx chooses the sharpest and clearest formulation of the question against the anarchists. While overthrowing the yoke of the capitalist, should the workers lay down their arms, or use them against the capitalists in order to break their resistance? But the systematic use of arms by one class against another class, what is that if not the transient form of the state? End quote. Lenin's view of revolution as akin to a military campaign is again coming through here. If the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, will not give up power without a fight, and if a proletarian revolution succeeds in initially dethroning the ruling class, and if the bourgeoisie are still powerful enough to muster a counterattack, then how can the workers lay down their arms and expect to win? No army or fighting force can expect to survive if, in the middle of a battle, they all simply turn around and walk away, leaving their armaments to be used by the enemy. But as we have seen Lenin argue, the difference this time is that when the proletariat wins the war, and socialism succeeds, there will be no more class struggle to wage. It is, in effect, the true war to end all wars. State and Revolution has, perhaps, one of the most famous endings to a theoretical socialist work in history, and it's simply too good not to be included. Quote, "The current brochure was written in August and September of 1917. A plan for a following seventh chapter had already been put together by me, the experience of Russian revolutionaries in 1905 and 1917. But, other than the title, I did not manage to write a single line of the chapter. A political crisis, the eve of the October Revolution, interfered. One can only be delighted by such an interference. But the second edition of the brochure, dedicated to the experience of Russian revolutionaries in 1905 and 1917, will have to, perhaps, be put off for a while. It is more pleasant and useful to create the experience of a revolution than to write about it." End quote. And mic drop. The two works chosen here represent just a small fraction of what Lenin produced over his lifetime. Many of those works and writings will be referenced as we move forward. But now that we've gone through the main arguments of these two influential books, we can finally give a working definition of the revolutionary tendency of Leninism. It is the position that a vanguard party, directly composed of and connected with the workers, informed by their experiences and guided by Marxist theory, is necessary to help raise the revolutionary potential and class consciousness of the working class. This party should operate on the organizational principle of democratic centralism, according to which all members of the group have equal say in developing tactics and strategy, but are then expected to act in unison after a majority decision has been reached. The ultimate long-term goal of this party should be to guide the workers toward the seizure of state power and the creation of a dictatorship of the proletariat. Once created, this new worker state must work not only to bring about the material conditions of communism, but also remain vigilant and ready to repel any attempts at undermining from within or destruction from without. And that's it. Congratulations on making it to the end. I truly hope you found this to be informative, especially since these are concepts and ideas we will see put into practice throughout our series. I'm pleased to say that the ideology-dense and quote-heavy episodes are over for now. Next episode, we will do a run-through of the groups we will be dealing with during the revolutionary period: the Liberal Cadet Party, the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party and its split into the two factions, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, and also the SRs and their ideological roots. But before we go, I would give a final word of encouragement to anyone interested in reading Lenin themselves. Translations are easily found for most of his writings on the archival website marxist.org. Or, if you're like me and enjoy holding real books, check your local library or bookstore. Even what we discussed here was only a small fraction of what Lenin had to say in these works, and I hope I've demonstrated in these episodes so far that there is no real substitute for reading what these thinkers and activists had to say for themselves in their own words. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.